Thank you. I appreciate that. I will admit that in view of some of the talk that's been going around lately, I was a little disturbed to find the high percentage of you here today that aren't voters in California. Do you know, it's been a long time since I spoke to your club. Some years ago, right after a great episode in the history of the motion picture business, I was a speaker here explaining to you some of the things that had taken place in the communist attempt to infiltrate and take over the motion picture business. And I remember at that time, I also spoke of the extent to which the people in our industry had been discriminated against by our own government. And I pointed out to you that if this could take place to any group of citizens, that perhaps the day wasn't far off when it could happen to other groups of citizens and that your freedoms too would be endangered. I kind of think I'm standing here today in a capacity of I told you so. You know, this title, Freedom, isn't spelled with an S. It is just that simple. Freedom isn't divisible. We can't elect, as some people urge us to do, to choose one freedom and give up another. We can't elect to be partly free and partly controlled. Now, I've been protesting the growth of government for a number of years. I've been in the mashed potato circuit so long that at home, if they serve hard rolls, I just automatically stand up and say, Mr. Toastmaster, ladies and gentlemen. I've been concerned lest the permanent structure of government becomes so big as to be virtually beyond the control of Congress. And we see evidence today where this permanent structure, the appointees of the executive branch of government, literally thumb their nose at Congress. And they determine and dictate policy. Now, I've seen an interesting development. Some years ago, when I first started talking on this and suggested the danger of government control that was inherent in federal aid projects, I was met with vehement denials that the federal government could offer help without, at the same time, exerting control. But before too many years had gone by, there was a subtle change. I was still singing the same song, changes in the lyrics, of course, but the same people who had criticized at first were now saying, well, what's wrong with federal control? And today, we're repeatedly asked, are you afraid of your own government? Well, to tell you the truth, I am. And I think all of us should be. Regardless of who is in power or what administration, we were warned from the very beginning by the Founding Fathers, over and over again, that government, all governments, just tend to grow. They increase in power until eventually freedom is lost, even though it's inadvertent, and that only government is capable of tyranny. And these warnings have come to us, Jefferson, Madison, regardless of any party, Woodrow Wilson. For example, let me give you a warning. Just a few years ago, a United States senator said the scarlet thread running through the thoughts and actions of people all over the world is the delegation of a great number of vital problems to the all-absorbing Leviathan, the state. Every time that we try to lift a problem to the government, to the same extent we are sacrificing the liberties of the people. And the senator who said that was John Fitzgerald Kennedy. So this fear of the power and the growth of government does cross party lines. Now I realize, in spite of this, that it's a controversial subject. But then, to tell you the truth, everything is. There was a man knocked on a door one day, and a small boy answered the door. And the man said, is your father home? And the boy said, no. He said, is your mother home? And the kid said, no. And kind of nonplussed, the man said, well, son, I'm your uncle on your father's side. And the kid stepped back and said, well, I guess you can come in, but I'll tell you right now, you're sure as hell on the wrong side. But you know, because so much of government growth has been concerned with welfare problems, there's a tendency on the part of many to accuse others of lacking in humanity if they question the omnipotence of the welfare state. Now, we can view conservatives as reactionaries who are opposed to all change and progress. Likewise, liberals, as bleeding hearts who'd sacrifice all freedom to sacrifice the material to satisfy the material needs of the less fortunate. And I'm sure that these descriptions would fit some people in both these two ideologies. But I'm sure that the majority of both viewpoints fall in between, in a ground where there should be some possibility of discussing without bitterness the viewpoints and discussing what price in freedom we're willing to pay for security. Now, I'm frank to admit that I'm alarmed at the extent of the loss in individual freedom that we have undergone in recent years. You could go all the way, of course, in the one direction to individual freedom, to the point without law and order where you have anarchy. And obviously this is extremist. But by the same token, if you are willing to trade freedom for security, you can arrive finally at the concept in which the most secure man in the world today is serving a life sentence in prison. And all he had to do was give up all of his freedom. But he bought total security all the way up to and including prepaid burial. Now, 100 years ago, England's Lord Macaulay wrote a letter to an American friend. And he spoke of our republic, and he drew a parallel. He said in the 5th century AD, ancient Rome was overrun by the Vandals and Huns and fearfully plundered. He said in the mid-20th century, and that's the approximate period we're in, he said, your republic will be fearfully plundered by the Vandals and Huns, but with this difference. Rome's barbarians came from without. Your barbarians will have been engendered by your own democratic institutions. Now, perhaps what he had in mind was what a Professor Alexander Fraser Tytler has said about democracy. He says it actually cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse out of the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the treasury, with the result that democracy collapses over a loose fiscal policy, always to be followed by a dictatorship. Now, we can't argue with the professor. He's not around anymore. When he said that, we were colonials of Great Britain, and he was explaining what had destroyed the Athenian Republic more than 2,000 years before. But somehow, we can get an echo of his prophecy when we see in the poverty program the argument going on as to whether political heads or the recipients of the grants, the poor themselves, should have the biggest voice in administering the poverty funds. And suddenly you step back and scratch your head and say, well, now just a minute. Isn't anybody going to argue about those of us who are putting up the money in the first place? Shouldn't we have something to say about how it's doled out? We live in a schizophrenic world. We live in unprecedented ease and prosperity. But somehow it's hard for me to accept that we're on a broad highway speeding ever onward and upward, as some of the voices from Washington would have us believe. I'm troubled myself by a suspicion that maybe we're enjoying the exhilaration of a toboggan ride, but there's a curve down there and I can't see what's just around the curve. A few weeks ago, we ended the fiscal year, and almost automatically, for the fifth time in 4 years, Congress raised the debt limit. The gold supply is so diminished that we fear for the solvency of our currency. The cost of living, particularly in foodstuffs, has reached an all-time high. But the farmer who produces that foodstuff is receiving the lowest percentage of the market basket dollar in all our nation's history. We pretend we're at peace, and we can look around at our smiling countryside and the happy people on our streets and believe we are at peace. Until we stop and think that probably as of this moment, a few Americans are dying someplace on our behalf. And as far as those Americans who are dying are concerned, it's total war. We move toward a welfare state with unprecedented federalization of American life. Subsidies proliferate and security becomes so all important as to override self-reliance, self-respect, and even simple morality. Now we hear serious discussion by supposedly learned men granted to the idea that not only should we help those in need, but we should actually divorce income from work with a central authority satisfying not only the people's needs, but their wants, regardless of whether they contribute anything to the nation's welfare or not. The great French philosopher de Tocqueville warned that such a government would cover the face of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform, and thus the will of man is not shattered, but softened and guided until the nation is reduced to a flock of timid and industrial animals of which government is the shepherd. Well, at the first hearing, again, we're inclined to doubt that we're within even distant gunshot of such a possibility. But I wonder if our complacency is justified. Freedom is very fragile. We've only known it a few moments in all man's history, and most of those moments have been ours. But now our limited government, with its decentralized powers, has given way to planners, economists in the nation's capital who've laid an increasingly heavy hand on every facet of our lives. I sometimes think, when I hear of some of the utterances of these economists who've breathed too deeply of the mists off the Potomac, of a definition I learned when I was getting my own degree in economics. An economist, that's somebody with a Phi Beta Kappa key at one end of his watch chain and no watch at the other end. Sometimes when I survey their efforts, I think if all of them were laid end to end, they wouldn't reach a conclusion. Once in this country, we had a system of checks and balances, where we still have plenty of checks, but someplace along the line, we've lost our balance. If we ever decide we need a new Declaration of Independence, I hope we'll keep one line from the old. He has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Federal employees today outnumber state employees in 30 of our 50 states, including California. And in California, this isn't easy to do. Because during a period when we've doubled our population in this state, we have quadrupled the number of state employees. In the last few years, we've added another 50,000. And in this same period, we have increased our state expenditures 10 times over. The federal government increasingly competes with the private businessman in almost every line of activity. And to date, government-owned corporations have lost $81 billion. In this unfair competition. That's more than a fourth of the national debt, and it's hardly a recommendation for those who say that the government should take an increasing hand in regulating the nation's economy. It is estimated that 35% of the businessman's time is spent filling out government forms and complying with government-ordered paperwork. It is estimated that this paperwork costs American industry $20 billion a year. In addition to $7 billion a year that it costs the federal government alone to keep track of this paperwork. And yet the threat of even more regulation and almost complete takeover is with us. Robert Weaver, Federal Housing Administrator, has made a public statement that while the government once gave control of the land to the people in order to speed its development, it is now the policy of the federal government to seek to gain completely regain control of the use of the land. Similar statements have been made by the Federal Power Commission with regard to reclaiming, as they put it, all the hydroelectric facilities that are now in private utility hands. We've seen our states, and this would apply to our own, literally abdicate and abandon their sovereignty as they become little brothers to Big Brother. And are prepared in return for so-called federal handouts to become nothing more than administrative districts for an all-powerful federal government. We saw such an example here last year when one man at least who was running for office in this state and was elected, thank heaven, tried over and over again to warn what was going to happen if the Bracero was eliminated from our fields in this, the greatest agricultural section in the entire world. And he was poo-pooed and told that he didn't know what he was talking about. How could he forsake the footlights and the song and dance routine to know what lyrics he should be singing? And now we hear a whimper coming from the state capitol that someone in Sacramento was misinformed, and it turns out that the song and dance man knew his lyrics pretty well, and we reap the harvest. Have we heard a voice rise up in defense of our own citizens in the Imperial Valley, or how many of you know what has taken place there? I don't know whether you know this, but some 30-odd years ago, when they were starting the Imperial Valley Irrigation District, the federal government wanted in on what was a private project. and in return for being allowed in, the federal government agreed that in that area, those people would not be bound by the 160-acre limitation for irrigation projects. Well, the people in the Imperial Valley now, 30 years later, have just been notified by the federal government that beginning August 31st, they'll have to start getting rid of all land they own above 160 acres because the federal government is just not going to be bound by the contract it signed. And as I say, no voice is raised in behalf of those people. Louis Levine, United States Director of Employment, backed by a $200 million budget, says the ultimate goal of his agency is to make the United States Employment Service the manpower agency for the entire nation, and there will no longer be any need for private employment agencies. Every businessman could tell, I'm sure, his own story of such harassment. I have one I like to tell. Forgive me if you've heard it before. It's about the natural gas producers. They've just been handed a 428-page questionnaire, weighs 10 pounds. The pages are 2 feet long, room for hundreds of entries on every page. They have to fill it out in quadruplicate. One firm has estimated it'll take 17,000 accountant man-hours to complete this questionnaire. The Power Commission says this is the only way they can determine whether they're charging the right price for gas. Are we safe on our books and our records? Just recently, we found revealed that the Post Office has been turning over to the Federal, or the Internal Revenue Service, letters addressed to people who are back or delinquent in their income taxes. Planes equipped with surveying instruments fly over our farms, checking from the air accurately to determine whether a farmer has violated his planting allotment. And if he has, no day in court, he's fined for the violation, and if his fine isn't paid, they seize and sell his property at auction to enforce the payment of that fine. Our government involvement in this farm economy, I'd never tire of talking about it because it gives us the greatest example of what happens when government abandons its true province and begins to interfere in the private economy. Here in this land, in a world where man from the beginning of time has been unable to adequately produce food and fiber for himself and his family, here in this land, our farmer has developed his craft to the point of genius. The only place in the world where the farmer can feed not only himself, but literally hundreds of his fellow citizens. But triggered by the Depression, the government set out to help the needy farmer with a subsidy. And today they're giving 80% of the subsidy funds to the 1/4 of the farms that have the highest income. A year ago, the wheat farmers voted against the subsidy in the regulation program, and they found out you don't say no to Santa Claus because the government waited a while and then passed the program anyway. And they achieved a new high in bureaucratic ingenuity. They increased the price of flour to the consumer, they decreased the price of wheat to the farmer, and they decreased exports, and they handed the taxpayer a $100 million bill for accomplishing all this. The taxpayer, that's someone who works for government and doesn't have to take a civil service exam. For every dollar that we've spent on price stabilization in the farm economy since 1948, we are spending $25 today. And with what result? Well, 2 million farmers have left the soil and gone to the city in search of jobs. We're told that we now can get rid of another 2.5 million. And the farm debt in relation to income is the highest in history, even on the eve of the 1929 crash. $2.86 the farmer owes for every dollar of net income that he has coming in. Our traditional laws of eminent domain, they recognize that the government occasionally would need to take from a private citizen property. Upon the presentation of evidence that there was a clear and present need and that only this particular piece of property could satisfy that need. Now a variety of programs have diluted the private property rights by making public interest anything a few planners decide it should be. We've adopted an urban renewal program. The original intent was to make quickly available decent homes for every American by eliminating slums. Now, no one disagrees with that humanitarian purpose, but since 1949, this program, in addition to being overly costly, has been destructive of personal liberty and has failed dismally in its original intent. In a 10-year period, we destroyed under that program 126,000 low-rent housing units and replaced them only with 28,000 housing units of a higher rent. In the meantime, almost 1 million people, displaced by the bulldozer have wound up in new slums paying higher rent. Now, the law says the displaced must be offered standard housing at rents they can afford in convenient locations. But for heaven's sake, if standard housing in convenient locations at rents they could afford had already been available, they'd have moved there without waiting for an urban renewal program. Meantime, while the government was only able to come up with 28,000 units, private enterprise in the same period was building 27 million housing units. Now, let me make it plain. I don't challenge the sincerity of these planners. I really mean that. I honestly believe these people are sincerely motivated. They have a humanitarian goal, and they are eyeing perhaps too much the problem without seeing the risk of some of their solutions. They just want to help. But I think sometimes when I think of them helping, it's like the young kid who was riding a motorcycle on a cold winter day and the wind was cutting in through the buttonholes on the leather jacket and making him uncomfortable till he figured something out. He turned the jacket around, put it on backward. This solved the cold problem, but it restricted his arm motion a little bit. And he hit a patch of ice and skidded into a tree. When the ambulance got there, one of the attendants elbowed his way through the crowd of bystanders and said, "What happened?" And one of them said, "Well, we don't know. When we got here, he seemed to be all right, but by the time we got his head turned around straight, he was dead." Now we're to have a new cabinet post, a cabinet officer of urban affairs. And we're going to have a program, we're told, of subsidizing rents so that a man can live in a house above his means with his thrifty new neighbors helping to pay his rent. Urban renewal plans will, quote, be used in a new way so that all our tools, from poverty program to education and construction, can be used to create meaningful and livable communities within our cities. And of course, again, the nation's capital will decide what is meaningful. We have a poverty program, and like charity, it begins at home. And in this case, home happens to be the people administering the program. They've just awarded one area, Gum Springs, Virginia, $74,000, $54,000 for administrator's salaries and $20,000 for the poor. The mayor of Paterson, New Jersey's upset. He's just discovered that the poverty director in his town's getting $1,000 a year more than he is. The youth phase of this program is going to salvage young people who, in the kindest sense I say this, have failed to meet their responsibility in preparing themselves for adult life. Now, again, no one quarrels with the goal. But during this salvage operation, we're going to pay them more than we pay the young man who dons a uniform and goes to Vietnam in defense of his country. A senator recently, if you didn't see this story, it's worth repeating. A senator recently in Washington, or a congressman, reported the story of two young men from his district who are brothers. One of them is defending his country in Vietnam for $78 a month. The other one, his brother, is a dropout who was arrested for beating their mother, and he's getting $200 a month running a power mower at a country club as a part of the poverty program. Now, the pattern follows, of course, with regard to the dropouts. In one area, we know, of course, that part of the reason for dropouts from school is the need to earn money. So in the dropout retraining program, we're making employment available to these young men at the same time that they continue their education. And in one area already, the rate of pay for the dropout is so much higher than the legitimate rate of pay for students who have part-time jobs that they've created an inducement for the students to drop out so they can get their education and get a raise in pay at the same time. Here in the young ladies program that's going on in Los Angeles, where they've taken over a 13-story hotel, $7,000 a year we spend for each young lady that we're going to try and salvage. Hell, if we gave the $7,000 to their families to begin with, we would eliminate poverty and we could give back the hotel. Do we no longer think that it's necessary to teach the simple virtues of reward for labor or to repay when we borrow? There's a Rotary Club here in California in a small college town. They've had as a project for some years a fund, a lending fund. They help students, needy students in this college, by lending money. No interest, and they don't have to pay it back until after graduation. The dean of the college has just called the Rotary Club a short time ago and told them that unless they're willing to make the money an outright gift, the college won't need it anymore because the federal government's putting up the money and the students don't have to pay it back. Samuel Gompers said doing for people what they can and ought to do for themselves. is a dangerous experiment. In the last analysis, the welfare of the worker depends on his own initiative. Let social busybodies and professional morals experts in their fads reflect upon the perils they rashly invite under the pretense of social welfare. The network of rules grows more minute. Now we're going to subsidize, they tell us, art and literature, with two czars appointed at the federal level, empowered to grant millions of dollars on the basis of their opinion of what constitutes meaningful art. Now, maybe I'm unduly disturbed by this, but if they follow some of the programs or the pattern that's been set in scientific research, I'm not an expert in science, never was very good at it at all, but I do get disturbed when I see the government spending thousands of dollars on research in philology and faunal affinities of fossil bryozoa in the middle Ordovician through Silurian. The only thing about that that I understand is that line in the middle. There I know who they're talking about. The nation's capital is concerning itself with our ability to enjoy ourselves in the great outdoors. There's a new booklet put out by the federal government. This new booklet has 134 pages of profundities. I don't know how we got along without it up till now. It says, for example, if you're going to lay out a campsite, you should provide drinking fountains at such height that the drinking level is convenient for the people who are going to be using the fountains. But wait till you get to the exciting part on wildlife. It says insects crawling into the ears of outdoorsmen sometimes create painful conditions. Well, I got news for them. It's no fun when it happens indoors. But this isn't all they have to say on wildlife. If your recreational area has a bathhouse intended for the use of both men and women, it should be divided into two parts by a tight partition. Now, you know we'd have never thought of that by ourselves. Professor Teitler's loose fiscal policy is at hand. The federal government spends $260 million a day, $10 million a day more than we were spending 1 year ago. Here in California, it took us 100 years to reach a $1 billion budget, only 9 years to double it, and only 5 years to double that. And you wonder if we're supposed to make it $8 billion in 2.5 years. Our government is responsible for a deliberate and planned inflation that has reduced the purchasing power of the dollar in our lifetime to less than 35 cents. When my father, when I was a boy, used to tell me the country needed a good 5 cent cigar. What this country needs is a good 5 cent nickel. The government practices bookkeeping tricks that would jail any of you as a private businessman if you tried them. Over and over again and year after year, we're told the budget hasn't reached the magic $100 billion mark. But each year we find out in the budget message that they ask for obligational spending authority several billion dollars in excess of $100 billion. Medicare presented again in that piecemeal foot-in-the-door attitude that it'll only cost a few pennies a month to each person. And so it will. Because we operate our government today on a dollar down and pay later basis. But take a look at what happens in 3 years, just after, by coincidence, the 1968 election, and then catch a view of the jump that will take place in the Social Security tax for Medicare. We've dropped our gold supply from 70% of the world's supply to one-third, just since 1948 when we started federal aid. And the ink spattered on our embassies in hate American campaigns is bought by American taxpayers. And we go along with the hypocrisy. Our State Department each time pretends that you could have a spontaneous riot in a police state, and we send a message to the government of that state saying, send more police. It'd make more sense and we'd have more self-respect if we sent them a note sometime and said, send a smaller mob. We're taxed in our food and our drink and our shelter, with the government taking a higher percentage from the free economy than any society has ever done without ruin. They cut the excise tax $5 billion, and that's fine, but they add another $5 billion in the same time in the deficit. Actually, any talk of tax reform, either at our state level or the federal government, is revealed as nothing more than a sort of merry-go-round in which they shift and rearrange the tax burden under the pretense that you can rob Peter to pay Paul. Well, it's time we woke up to the fact that we've been robbing Paul to pay Paul, because neither Peter nor anyone else is loaded anymore. Government is like a baby. It's an elementary canal, an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. Now the government tells us in an atmosphere of emergency that it's going to help us with our school problems, in spite of the fact that competent educators have said there is no problem that cannot be solved at the local or state level. And when they went to Washington with a suggestion as to how more money could be left at the local level without the federal government putting its hand into this, the Freudian slip occurred and Francis Keppel, director of education, said, You don't understand, under such a plan, the government couldn't recognize or realize its social objectives. Well, if government's going to build the schools, buy the books and grant the scholarships and make judgments and exert pressure, what if one day that pressure is of a nature not to our liking? Education is the bulwark of freedom. But when you remove it too far from the community and the parents' control, it becomes the tool of tyranny. If we're men of goodwill, isn't it time for the conservative to explain openly the extent to which he believes society is responsible for seeking the elimination of misery and poverty and disease and ignorance? But by the same token, shouldn't the liberal state how far he intends to go in regimenting society in an effort to attain that same objective? If he really means welfare at any price, then I think honesty demands that he give the people a right to choose by telling how far he actually intends to go. There's something dishonest in putting over under one name piecemeal welfare programs leading toward totalitarianism without letting the people know what the end result is going to be. Now, you can reason that as businessmen, you shouldn't involve yourselves. Well, I can give you one reason why, as businessmen, you can't afford not to involve yourselves in politics. You spend time and effort to improve efficiency in your business, sometimes only to attain a fraction of 1% of a gain in profit. And yet one government act, a tax increase, a change in zoning, a new regulatory ordinance can wipe out all your hard-earned gains and all the things that you've accomplished with your effort at efficiency. Mismanagement is as costly to government as it is to business. And the only trouble is, who foots the bill when government goofs? And of course, you, the businessman, have to foot it. Private ownership disappears as private control is lost. Daniel Webster said, nothing will ruin the country if the people themselves will undertake its safety. And nothing can save it if they leave that safety in any hands but their own. It's up to us. Are we willing to study the issues, to be aware, to convey information to family and friends, to actually take a part in who and how we're going to run our government? Resist the temptation to get a so-called free federal handout in your community while we're asking for economy in the other fellow's district. I think it's time we realize that the doctor's fight against socialized medicine is our fight. You can't socialize the doctor without socializing the patient. I think it's time we realize, regardless of our business or profession, that government's assault on the investor-owned utility is eventually an assault on every business. We have to demand an end to deficit spending. We're faced with the most evil enemy that mankind has ever known. And there can be no security anywhere in the free world in this moment if there isn't fiscal and economic stability within the United States. In all of history, every time a cultured, advanced society has met the less cultured, the barbarian has triumphed. Is man born with certain unalienable rights, or does he exist only by permission of and for the sake of the group? If we accept the collectivist high-sounding phrase, the greatest good for the greatest number, are we not agreeing that the individual has ceased to have any importance and that 50% of the people plus one can impose anything they want on the rest simply because they outnumber them? If we agree to that, we march toward eternity. Just what the communist says, we are soulless freaks of nature operating in a super ant heap. Either the power of society is limited or it is not. We can't have it both ways. Unfortunately, some among us fear to take a part in public affairs, fear participation, fear that there'll be reprisal from customers or clients who disagree, or perhaps even punishment from government, and that's becoming an increasing threat in these days. But you can't afford to stand on the sideline anymore. If you do, you're just feeding the crocodile, hoping he'll eat you last. But eventually, it'll come your turn. We've come to our moment of truth, the moment when we decide whether the enemy is right and we have grown soft. We lighted a torch here 200 years ago that said to the world's downtrodden that here the greatest advance had been made in all history, because here men had banded together and had pledged their collective strength to guarantee not only the freedom, but the dignity and the rights of even the least individual among them. If we let that torch go out, we dim the golden hope of mankind for generations to come. And if we're unwilling to meet the challenge of our generation, meet the challenge of our destiny, then I think in the years ahead, you and I'd better start planning on what it is we're going to tell our children and our children's children that we found more precious than freedom, because they're going to want to know. Thank you.